Israeli forces massacre 63 more Palestinians in Gaza in a matter of 24 hours, as the total death toll from the regime's genocide tops 31,500. The World Health Organization warns that Israel's looming ground assault on Rafah in southern Gaza will lead to more Palestinian deaths and suffering. And another Palestinian captive falls victim to systematic torture in Israeli jails, becoming the 13th inmate to die in the regime's prison since October the 7th. Thank you for joining us. Now, over 5 months into Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, and the regime continues pounding the blockaded territory with indiscriminate airstrikes and artillery fire. The health ministry in Gaza says at least 63 people have been killed and 112 others wounded in the latest round of Israeli attacks. According to the ministry, Israel prevents medical teams from reaching victims who are still under the rubble. Meanwhile, Israeli jets continue bombing residential buildings across the coastal strip, including Gaza City. The suffering in Gaza is not just limited to being targeted by bombs. According to UNRWA, malnutrition and famine are striking northern Gaza and is now moving to southern areas. Since the onset of the Israeli war in early October, over 31,500 Palestinians have been killed, most of them women and children. The head of the World Health Organization calls on Israel not to launch a ground offensive on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where 1.5 million displaced Palestinians have sought shelter. Tedros Ghebreyesus said the escalation of violence in Rafah would lead to many more deaths and suffering. He called on Israel to refrain from the attack in the name of humanity. Tedros added that people in Rafah are too fragile, hungry and sick to move around. On Friday, the Israeli Prime Minister approved plans to assault Rafah, despite increasing international calls to halt the military operations. Israel's genocidal war on Gaza has cast a somber tone over this year's holy month of Ramadan in the besieged Strip. Palestinians there are in dire need of food, grappling with the devastating impacts of the relentless Israeli bombardment and the crippling siege. Our correspondent in Gaza, Moti Abu Musabbe, has talked to some of the displaced Gazans who describe their plight.
I was displaced after the Israeli forces attacked our neighborhood. As you can see, we live in these tents made of plastic and fabric. We have nothing to eat but some canned food, which is the only thing that we have been eating for roughly 6 months. We don't even have gas to cook. I have 6 children and I don't know what to feed them.
I have been displaced from the Nusayrat refugee camp. I have 5 children. I came from Algeria to visit Gaza and then the war erupted. I hadn't expected that the situation could be as bad as it is. The situation is beyond catastrophic here, as people can barely find food, especially in this holy month of Ramadan.
This Ramadan is completely different from previous years. My 5 kids and I have been displaced from Gaza City while my husband is still there. We have no source of food. The amount of food provided by charities is also scarce. We're devastated and deprived of our basic needs.
I live here with my 8 children. Our lives are tragic. The situation is getting worse day by day. We're struggling to cope with this unbearable condition amid the relentless bombardment and bloodshed. In Ramadan, we are completely relying on the food provided by donors. Sometimes the food is scarce and we get nothing to eat. Eating canned food has also made us sick.
We have been displaced from northern Gaza. There are 7 of us living here. We are suffering a lot. The weather is too cold and there are no gas supplies. Because of that, I have to make a fire to cook food. Most of the time, we find no food or milk for the children. They always cry and get sick. The Israeli war has destroyed everything in Gaza.
Israel's systematic torture and abusive treatment of Palestinian prisoners have claimed the life of another inmate. According to Palestinian officials, 26-year-old Juma Abu Ghanima died in an Israeli prison after suffering a serious health condition that required hospitalization. His death brings to 13 the number of prisoners died in Israeli jails due to torture and medical negligence since October the 7th. In a statement, Palestinian Prisoner Society said Israel has significantly increased its torture and systematic medical negligence against Palestinian detainees in the past months. Israel keeps over 9,000 Palestinians in jails, many of them under the so-called administrative detention. The controversial and internationally condemned policy allows the regime to keep Palestinians behind bars for an indefinite period of time without trial. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has appointed Mohammed Mustafa as the new Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority. Mustafa, a U.S.-educated economist and former senior World Bank official, replaced Mohammed Shatayeh, who resigned 3 weeks ago, citing the emerging reality in the Gaza Strip. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Munar Kandil, has interviewed some of the Palestinians who have described their views about the newly appointed Prime Minister. Let's see what they had to say.
We are all Palestinians and we are the sons of this country. Anyone who will be in charge of the government is supposed to respond to the demands and hopes of the people. So the issue of bringing some politician to impose policies won't be welcomed, because we Palestinians know very well what we want.
For almost 30 years, we've been waiting to have an independent state, but instead, we have only moved from a bad situation to a worse. If we get the chance to have an independent state, then we may witness better circumstances. Otherwise, we don't need any governments, and let's return to the situation before 1987, before the first Intifada. Because literally, we are held in a big prison divided into cantons.
We're really frustrated. We don't expect that there will be any true change. What we are witnessing is a change of the names. There was Dr. Hamdallah, and then Shatayeh came. But nothing really has changed except for the politicians in charge. I don't think the coming cabinets will be able to rebuild Gaza. It's not easy. We have no trust in any Arab official, whether here or from the Arab countries. Since what happened in Gaza, we have lost hope and confidence in everyone.
To be honest, the majority of people here don't know Mohammed Mustafa, but it's said that he is a man with great capabilities. We hope he'll be able to form a new government and succeed in choosing his ministers. The most important thing for us is to change the current situation in every possible aspect.
We are in a very tragic and very difficult situation, and the tasks that are assigned to the new prime minister are not easy. So if he is not able to mobilize the countries all over the world to stand with us, then people are going to completely lose their trust in the government.
Thousands of Israelis have once again rallied in Tel Aviv to protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over his failure to secure the release of the captives in Gaza. The protesters urged Netanyahu to resign and called for holding early elections. They vowed to continue their protests until all the captives are released. Netanyahu has been in hot water over his handling of the Gaza war. Israel has so far failed to release any of the captives by military means. It has also failed to achieve any of its stated goals of the war. Israel has been the scene of anti-Netanyahu rallies for months. The Israeli premier is embroiled in a series of scandals. His charges, amongst others, include fraud and breach of trust in three cases filed in 2019. The Hezbollah resistance movement has launched attacks on several Israeli positions near southern Lebanon. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, says the group seeks to totally destroy Israeli military posts near Lebanon. Let's take a listen.
The first post that was targeted was the al-Baghdadi post. We also had a very significant operation against the Ramim barracks, where Hezbollah launched a Burkan rocket. Hezbollah seems to be also attempting to completely destroy many of the Israeli posts that have been, of course, put forth since the year 2000 after the Israeli withdrawal from South Lebanon. And that has caused significant damage and destruction to their posts, and also, of course, a very high cost. We also had a targeting of al-Malikiya post using mortars. We've heard from the Israeli expert, strategy expert, and military analyst, Alon Ben David, who's talking through the Daily Maariv. He stressed one of his articles that what we are looking at right now in the north, of course, they're calling it the Northern Front, that Hezbollah with not much effort. With a little bit of effort, with an acceptable cost on their part, from, for example, Hezbollah, what they have done is actually emptied out the northern parts. And with the fact that there's no decisions being taken by the Israelis, it seems that the possibility that many of the settlers who left that area will not actually live in that area any time in the future, and this will end any possibility of any settlers living in those towns, and we're talking about the northern occupied Palestinian territory. That is, of course, one of the signs that we are looking at. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah spoke about some of those signs, that there is a lot of disintegration within the Israeli society, and it is being emptied out, many of them actually threatening and warning that they will be leaving the occupied territories. That in itself is considered a huge achievement for the resistance in Lebanon, and even for the resistance, of course, in Palestine.
Israeli warplanes have carried out fresh airstrikes on Syria, targeting Damascus countryside. According to the Syrian military, the missiles were launched from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. It added the country's air defenses intercepted and shot down some of the missiles. The offensive resulted in one soldier being injured and some material losses. The Israeli regime frequently targets the war-ravaged Arab country, particularly areas in and around Damascus. The Syrian government has, on numerous occasions, called on the United Nations to force the Israeli regime to stop its acts of aggression. Damascus says the assaults are in violation of international law and aimed at propping up terrorists. A new pro-Palestine rally has been organized in Rome, this as the Italian defense minister has confirmed Rome's arms exports to Israel have continued despite a block announced last year. Max Civilli has more from Rome.
On Saturday, thousands of people joined a new rally in the Italian capital, organized, among the others, by the Movement of the Palestinian Students and the Association of the Palestinians in Italy. The initiative, dubbed Stop the Genocide, also saw the participation of high school students and families. People at the rally strongly condemned Italy's unwavering support to the Israeli regime.
Italy, that claims to be a democratic nation, is a country where the government goes against the people's will. Profits always come first, even when a genocide is taking place. I'm teaching my kids to never give up the fight and to never accept being submitted.
The Italian Defense Minister Guido Crosetto has recently said that Rome has continued to export arms to Israel despite assurances last year that the government was blocking such sales following Tel Aviv's invasion of the Gaza Strip. Some Italian media reports recently revealed that despite the Italian government's denials, the value of arms sales to Israel more than tripled in December 2023 compared with the same month in 2022. And December last year was the peak of Israeli bombardments on the Gaza Strip.
Western governments have been systematically supporting Zionism and Israel's criminal regime, notwithstanding the protests against Israel's crimes that have been taking place across the globe. Italy's support to Tel Aviv must stop once and for all.
La soluzione sarebbe...
A solution to the onslaught in Gaza could be found if the international community stopped militarily supporting Israel. Italy, on its side, has been actively arming Israel through companies such as Leonardo and others. If we don't make sure that the Palestinians' right to self-determination is protected, and nothing will ever change.
Earlier this week, more protests and initiatives in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians were held in several Italian cities, including Milan and Naples. Max Civilli, Rome.
Hundreds of Austrians have taken to the streets of the capital, Vienna, to once again condemn the US-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Waving Palestinian flags, the demonstrators gathered at Vienna's city center. The demonstration was part of the Israeli Apartheid Week, called by the BDS movement, which promotes boycotts against Israeli products and multinational companies linked to the regime. Protesters said taking part in the rally was their contribution to solidarity with Gaza. They said that European countries are complicit to the Israeli crimes. They also called for an immediate ceasefire and the delivery of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip. On the second day of the Russian presidential election, voters across the country cast their ballots in a process that is all but certain to extend President Vladimir Putin's rule by another 6 years. Voting took place at polling stations across Russia's 11 time zones, including online balloting in the region that broke away from Ukraine and rejoined the Russian Federation. Around 114 million Russians are eligible to vote in this year's election that will continue until Sunday. In the run-up to the vote, Putin boasted about battlefield successes in Ukraine, where the Russian troops have recently made gains. He also cited economic growth, saying the country's economy has proven to be resilient despite Western sanctions. Putin's victory appears highly probable, as none of the other three candidates in the race is a prominent challenger. The current election marks the eighth presidential election in Russia. This will be Putin's fifth term as president. With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Ayes, 30 days. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors. Every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So the ulama that are Muslim scholars took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. In the fifth episode of Ramadan special series, we are going to explain Ayah 124 of Surah Nisa of the Noble Quran. The ayah speaks on righteous deeds and the equality of man and woman in this regard. Stay tuned, please. Ramadan is the month of a banquet whose host is Allah, and everyone has been invited to the banquet. Fasting is not like Hajj, which is obligatory only when a Muslim is able, both physically and financially, to do it. Also, fasting is not like Khums or Zakat, which become obligatory for the additional amount of money or specific properties. Fasting also differs from daily ritual prayer, which is obligatory on everyone in any condition. Fasting is obligatory only during the blessed month of Ramadan for men and women who can abstain from eating and drinking for certain hours. Woman in Islam is equal to man in reproduction and continuation of generation. Man is father and woman is mother. Woman's role is not inferior to man. Both of them are essential for life. Allah says in Ayah 124 of Surah Nisa of the Noble Quran, "And whoever does righteous deeds, whether male or female, should be faithful. Such shall enter paradise, and they will not be wronged so much as speck on a date stone." Ayah 35 of Surah Ahzab of the Noble Quran also reads, "Indeed, the Muslim men and the Muslim women, and the faithful men and the faithful women, and the obedient men and the obedient women, and the truthful men and the truthful women, and the patient men and the patient women, and the humble men and the humble women, and the charitable men and the charitable women, and the men who fast, and the women who fast, and the men who guard their private parts, and the women who guard, and the men who remember Allah greatly, and the women who remember, Allah holds in store for them forgiveness and a great reward." This ayah clearly shows that man and woman are equal before God. The road to perfection and sublimity is open for human beings regardless of their gender. As for social and personal rights too, there is no difference between man and woman. What seems to be discrimination in a few specific laws is due to the differences of man's and woman's nature. Therefore, some advantages are granted to man and some others to woman. God names Pharaoh's wife Asiye as a role model for all faithful. He also names Prophet Noah's wife as a role model for unfaithful. It means that woman is the axis of good and evil for the whole mankind. The reality of woman's status and dignity has been ignored in human systems throughout centuries. Some civilizations considered women inferior to men. Some others even considered woman as an animal at the service of man. In the ancient Rome, man was the absolute authority at home. He could sell, lend, or donate his wife as a means of pleasure or service to others. If she committed sin, he had the right to punish her in any way that he wished. He was entitled to even kill her. This continued in the West till Renaissance and the so-called era of Enlightenment. With the onset of the Industrial Revolution and formation of capitalist system, a new phase of woman's slavery began. The capitalist system, in order to increase consumerism and coordinate the market of supply and demand, was in need of forging a hunger for consumption of goods. In view of this, the media controlled by capitalists modeled the tastes of society in line with their vested interest. Thus, people thought that they should consume more to have a happier life. This trend led women, consequently men, to excessive consumerism. Women, however, were harmed more due to their nature. Therefore, they started a competition towards physical show-off. In other words, profiteering media inculcated the feeling in women that their value and personality was related to exposing their female beauties and attractions. This turned women into tools in the hand of companies and tradesmen. Consequently, sexuality and nakedness became a norm, and little by little it became the highest criterion to evaluate women in the West. It is a matter of laughter that this magnitude of disrespect to women and instrumental use of them has ever since been introduced as support for women's rights, and Islam has been propagated as a violator of their rights. Ruling systems in the world have raised various claims on women since old times, and most of them have been formed with the motto of equality of the rights of men and women. The Islamic Republic system is not an exception in this respect. The Islamic Republic of Iran has put forward novel view on women, and that's why it has been the target of incessant assaults by enemies for 45 years. Iran's Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi said in an interview with the Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci in 1974, "In the life of man, woman is not considered anything except when she is beautiful and charming, keeping her female features. You women have never had a Michelangelo or Bach or even a great cook. You have had nothing great. Honestly, how many women have you seen in your interviews who are able to administer a country?" Imam Khomeini, the architect of the Islamic Revolution, however, says on human dimension of woman is a human and a great human. Woman is the trainer of society. Elsewhere, Imam Khomeini says on the Prophet's special attention to women, "The history of Islam is testimony to the unlimited respects of the Messenger of God to this noble child, to show that woman enjoys a special greatness in society such that if she is not superior to man, she is not inferior." The Imam's view is in total contrast to the Western culture. Imam Khomeini considers woman as the trainer and manager of family, as believes that woman's lap is the best school for educating children. He says on the status of mother, "The many rights of mothers cannot be counted and fulfilled. One night of mother for her child is more valuable than a committed father's life. The embodiment of affection and mercy in the bright eyes of mother is the ray of mercy and affection of the Lord of the worlds. The hadith that reads, 'Paradise is under the feet of mothers,' is a reality." The Noble Quran presents the best and loftiest descriptions on women. This eternal book of guidance says in Ayah 21 of Surah Rum, "And of his signs is that he has created for you mates from your own selves, that you may take comfort in them. And he ordained affection and mercy between you. There are indeed signs in that for those who reflect."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, here are some guidelines for fasting from the Holy Prophet's fifth infallible heir, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him, who quotes the Prophet's advice to Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari. "O Jabir, whoever fasts the days of Ramadan, stands for prayers in part of its nights, guards his or her sexual desires, reins in his or her tongue, lowers his or her gaze, and injures not the feelings of others, will become free of sins as on the day he or she was born."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. today's lesson, remember Allah, and Allah will remember you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service. Holy month of Ramadan. What a beautiful month indeed. Our congratulations and blessings to all of you across the world on this beautiful holy month of Ramadan. So we're talking about how if you remember Allah, Allah will remember you. Now, this is one of the beauties of the holy month of Ramadan, because we are encouraged to remember Allah. Now, this remembrance of Allah, this dhikr of Allah, this, I guess, remembrance is perhaps a good way to translate dhikr, even though dhikr is like this continuous knowledge of, or it is this continuous recitation of, but this recitation in its essence is done in order to keep Allah constantly in our remembrance, to constantly be aware of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mighty, the exalted. That's what dhikr or remembrance is. This is what we're talking about. But anyways, the holy month of Ramadan is a perfect opportunity for us to be able to constantly be in the remembrance of the Almighty Allah, to constantly be aware of the presence of the Almighty Allah. And so this is what we're talking about now on the program, is that if you remember Allah, Allah will remember you. Even though, if we want to go into some of the intricacies of it, if we don't remember Allah, Allah is still remembering us. But that the remembrance of Allah upon us when we are not remembering Allah is a kind of a different type of remembrance, right? It's not the same when you think about somebody or you speak with somebody and they respond to you as compared to you speaking to somebody and them ignoring you.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how if you remember Allah, Allah will remember you. Now, we had left the last part of the segment with this idea that there's a difference between when you speak with somebody and they speak back to you, as compared to you speaking with somebody and them ignoring you. So this is the kind of example that I wanted to bring up, that, you know, in this holy month of Ramadan, those people who remember Allah, Allah remembers them in a different manner than those people who don't remember Allah. So in our example, it's like an individual who ignores Allah. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mighty, the exalted, the supreme Lord, he does remember those individuals, of course. I mean, he's watching everything, he's hearing everything, he's seeing everything, he's witnessing everything, right? So he is remembering these individuals who aren't remembering him, but of course that is a different remembrance of Allah than upon those individuals who are constantly in the remembrance of Allah. So the focus and the attention, if you will, and the remembrance of Allah on, for example, the Imam of the Age, or the Ahlul Bayt in their respective times, or the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon all of them, the remembrance of Allah and the attention of Allah on them is much more than, for example, the evildoers of the planet in their respective eras, right? These are kind of common sense truths and realities. So the more we remember Allah in the holy month of Ramadan, the more Allah will remember us. And this is something that is found in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam as well. If you remember Allah, Allah will remember you. And the more you love Allah, the more Allah will love you. And this is something that we should definitely continue even after the holy month of Ramadan. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will monitor carefully the United States' intention to set up a pair in the Gaza Strip. The debate that took place between Biden and Netanyahu and its interactions with the regime. We will also go over the reality on the ground in Khan Yunis and fears of a sudden surge in the occupied West Bank with the start of the month of Ramadan, as well as the escalation of protests against Netanyahu following his failure to reach a captives exchange deal in light of the disagreements over the draft law on conscription. Regarding these topics, I welcome the researcher in Israeli affairs, Professor Saleh Abu Azza. Welcome, dear professor. Professor Saleh Abu Azza, what is the Israeli goal of report in the Hebrew media about the presence of the Iranian Red Crescent currently on the ground in Gaza to provide food and medical aid?
This means that the Hebrew media always sheds light on everything that is Iranian, especially since there is always talk about the Islamic Republic and its absolute support for the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. They post no comments if there is any flag other than the flags of the members of the Axis of Resistance, whether it is the Islamic Republic of Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, or Yemen. So at the beginning of the events of October 7th and the start of the Israeli-American aggression on the Gaza Strip, it was officially prohibited. The Israeli side informed the Egyptian side that there should be no entry of any Iranian aid into Gaza. But it seems that the Islamic Republic was able to bring food, medicine, etc. into the Gaza Strip, but not in the proportion that should enter. Meaning, there's still a high percentage of Iranian trucks belonging to the Red Crescent present in Egypt that have not crossed the Rafah crossing until this moment.
As for Netanyahu, who has so far failed to achieve his declared goals of aggression against Gaza, he suddenly announces the assassination of what he calls Hamas's number four, that is, the martyr Saleh al-Arouri, in light of what has been widely promoted in the regime about the possibility of the martyrdom of Commander Maran Issa in an Israeli bombing in Gaza. Professor Saleh Abu Azza, what did Netanyahu want by claiming responsibility for the assassination of Hamas's number four now, at this time, in light of the promotion of allegations by Israeli sources about the possible martyrdom of Commander Marwan Issa in Gaza?
First, there is propaganda practiced by Netanyahu and his team about making achievements against the Palestinian resistance, specifically against Hamas, especially since October 7th. He's been trying hard to eliminate the four leaders, Sinwar, Mohammed Deif, Marwan Issa, and al-Arouri, since the first moments of the aggression, to promote it as an image of victory. But we see that so far, he has only been able to assassinate Sheikh Saleh al-Arouri. But it was kind of by chance, because he didn't mean to, and Sheikh Saleh al-Arouri was actually carrying out part of his activities in an open area. I mean, he was exposed and easy to target. This brings no advantage for Israel.
So what do you think Benjamin Netanyahu wanted?
Now there are doubts about the assassination regarding al-Arouri. Israel usually does not go beyond the borders, especially when it comes to Syria, Iran, or Lebanon. But this time it has gone beyond and tries hard to present it as a victory for itself, saying that it has finally made an achievement within 6 months. Now we should note that it is not a matter of days or a round of combat until Netanyahu counts a set of four achievements, profits, and whatever he has achieved. Rather, we're talking about 6 months, and the military achievements are still not clearly visible to the Israeli citizen.
What confirms this is that the occupation forces are still stationed in Khan Yunis, the resistance leaders are still inside the tunnels, and the captives have not yet been released. If the situation continues as it is, there will be no defeat for Hamas. In the same context, analysts in the Hebrew media expressed fear for the occupation soldiers who are now in Khan Yunis with the escalation of resistance operations against them. This assessment was accompanied by speeches by Ehud Olmert, former head of the Zionist regime, in which he called for stopping the aggression against Gaza now, returning the Zionist captives, withdrawing the occupation army, and sending international forces into the Gaza Strip, as happened in southern Lebanon. Dear Professor, I draw attention to Ehud Olmert's words about stopping the aggression, withdrawing from Gaza, and sending international forces, as in southern Lebanon. How do you see this?
In the beginning, the resistance deals with any forces that enter Gaza without the resistance's consent, as they are occupation forces. This has been stated more than once. Even if they are multinational forces led by an Islamic country or another, because there were statements by a number of countries that they wanted to participate in that, so the Palestinian resistance preempted this. It declared that it would deal with any such force that wants to rule Gaza or manage its crossings or elsewhere as an occupying force. Now, in Khan Yunis, they are talking about ending Khan Yunis. We've seen these statements before, by the way. They said that we need a week to finish Khan Yunis. Now they admit that the army has 3.5 months in Khan Yunis. They previously said and promoted that we were able to enter the Al-Tufa neighborhood, the Al-Zaytun neighborhood, and the neighborhoods of the Gaza Strip, in the north of the Gaza Strip. Then it turned out that they would need weeks again to enter the Al-Zaytun neighborhood again. So the resistance has the ability to pull itself together, regain its capabilities, attack again, and carry out operations in the way it deems effective in the reality on the ground. This is what happens on a daily basis. Now there is a strong belief that the Palestinian resistance is exhausting Israel in the entire Gaza Strip.
I mean, it is clear, Mr. Saleh Abu Azza, that the Israeli occupation is enthusiastic about the idea of the sea pair in Gaza. I mean, how does Israel benefit from it, knowing that it is the one waging a war of starvation on the people of Gaza, and now it wants to bring in humanitarian aid? It doesn't make sense.
There are three main parties in this project: the United States, Israel, and the UAE. As for the United States, we find that it wants to present a good image of itself through humanitarian aid and is promoting it, especially in light of the crisis it is suffering from after the Michigan vote and other internal election races. He wants to win the Zionist lobby alongside the community that supports stopping the war on the Gaza Strip by providing this aid and pretending that he wants to distribute 1 million meals on this day, meaning that there is a kind of management of this hunger in a way that serves Biden electorally. When it comes to the Israeli regime, we see that the regime grants this. The pier is a sign that we will have an indefinite period for the continuation of the war. This means that there is a long war still going on, so the international parties must manage the area of hunger in the Gaza Strip in a way that serves the prolongation of this genocide.
The debate that occurred between Biden and Netanyahu recently received the attention of the Hebrew media, which have repeatedly pointed to the American president's statement criticizing the prime minister's Zionist policy and Netanyahu's response to it.
To defend Israel, a right to continue to pursue Hamas, but he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He's hurting Israel more than helping Israel by. But I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if he crosses and he cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead.
Well, I don't know exactly what the president meant. But if he meant by that I'm pursuing private policies against the majority, the wish of the majority of Israelis, and that this is hurting the interests of Israel, then he's wrong on both counts. They support the action that we're taking to destroy the remaining terrorist battalions of Hamas. They say that once we destroy the Hamas, the last thing we should do is put in Gaza, in charge of Gaza, the Palestinian Authority that educates its children towards terrorism and pays for terrorism.
Biden's statements were supported by a wide range of experts and commentators in the Hebrew media, who saw that Biden was right in his criticism of Netanyahu, who has burned the regime with Smotrich, as one of them put it. As for what happened, the Israeli media responded to Biden's statements and Netanyahu's response, and here are some of the comments.
Hadar.
Netanyahu is a despicable liar and a destroyer of Israel. Most people despise him.
Tami.
Netanyahu, you're living in a movie.
Itai.
This is not the case, and the truth is that most Israelis want to see you in prison.
Ben.
Most Israelis think you are a traitor.
Liad.
The majority are united against you.
Dan.
Netanyahu set an election date, and then we will see what most Israelis think of you.
Israel.
Netanyahu, most Israelis want to see you go to hell.
So, Professor Saleh Abu Azza, what is the background to the goals of Biden's criticism of Netanyahu and the latter's response to him in this way and what we saw? And how will it be reflected in this relationship that exists between the two sides?
The relationship between the United States and Israel is still based on strategic relations that cannot be overcome by differences over this or that issue. Therefore, although this dispute is being promoted in the media and exaggerated intentionally for the sake of Netanyahu, we cannot count on at all, at any moment, as anything other than an internal criticism within the Israeli regime. He always promotes the phrase that he is the most capable of withstanding American pressure and the most capable of withstanding international pressure that pretends to be against the continuation of the war. Now, we notice that the intensity of these public criticisms of Netanyahu has increased in this way after Gantz's visit. It's as if the speech he gave and these statements that Netanyahu made were in fact a response to Gantz's visit and his reception by the U.S. government rather than a response to what Biden says.
Mr. Saleh Abu Azza, specialist in Israeli affairs, thank you very much for participating in this episode of Israel Watch. Thank you for following up, and until we meet again, take care.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has seriously hindered the work of humanitarian agencies by blocking aid, targeting and killing humanitarian workers, destroying Palestinian food production, and cutting off Gaza's north, reducing Palestinians there to eating animal feed, bird seed, and leaves, unfit for human consumption. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Zionist regime's genocidal campaign in Gaza has entered its 6th month with around 31,000 Palestinian fatalities recorded since October 7th and no ceasefire on the horizon at the start of Ramadan. At least 25 Palestinians have been starved to death in Gaza due to the Zionist regime's engineered famine, among them 18 children. The children include a baby girl and a 10-year-old boy with cerebral palsy, according to the health ministry in Gaza. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, the true death toll due to starvation is feared to be much higher, as many Palestinians, particularly in northern Gaza, face famine and are almost entirely cut off from the limited humanitarian aid entering Gaza through the southern Rafah crossing. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vows to invade Rafah, where more than 1 million displaced people are concentrated along the border with Egypt. Israel bombed one of the largest residential high-rises in Rafah early on Saturday, March 9th, displacing dozens of families and raising fears that a ground invasion in the area may be imminent. The UN Human Rights Office said recently, "Any ground assault on Rafah would incur massive loss of life and would heighten the risk of further atrocity crimes. This must not be allowed to happen." Recently, South Africa filed its latest application to the International Court of Justice, urging the principal judicial organ of the United Nations to issue additional and amended provisional measures in light of new facts in its genocide complaint against the Zionist regime. The court declined to issue additional provisional measures after an application made by South Africa in mid-February, the judges stating that the perilous situation demands immediate and effective implementation of the provisional measures indicated by the court in its order of January 26th. In its application last week, South Africa states that the situation then perilous is now so terrifying as to be unspeakable, as described by United Nations humanitarian chiefs, justifying and indeed demanding the indication of further provisional measures of protection. South Africa called for a response to the Zionist regime's continuing violations and contempt for the court's interim ruling issued in late January, which found that the Zionist regime was plausibly carrying out a genocide in Gaza and ordered it to halt all genocidal acts. The provisional measures specifically order the Zionist regime to stop killing or causing serious bodily or mental harm to Palestinians in Gaza, prevent and punish incitement to commit genocide, take immediate and effective measures to enable basic services and humanitarian assistance and prevent the destruction of and ensure the preservation of evidence. The court also ordered the Zionist regime to submit a report to the tribunal on its compliance with the provisional measures within 1 month. South Africa argues in its latest application, the extreme gravity of the situation facing Palestinian men, women, children and babies, and the existential risk of the Palestinian people in Gaza as part of the Palestinian national or ethnic group faced as a result of Israel's genocidal military campaign demands further action by the court. South Africa compares its intervention with a similar one made by Bosnia in 1993, in which the tribunal was told that this will be the last opportunity that this court shall have to save both the people and the state of Bosnia and Herzegovina from extermination and annihilation by means of genocide. God will record your response to our request for the rest of eternity. It states, South Africa fears that this application may be the last opportunity that this court shall have to save the Palestinian people in Gaza, already dying of starvation and now one step from famine. In the Bosnia case, the court declined to order additional provisional measures. In the 2 years that followed, South Africa states, approximately 7,336 Bosnians in the so-called safe area of Srebrenica had been slaughtered in what this court retrospectively determined to have a genocide. The cost in human lives will likely be even higher in Gaza should the status quo persist. Since the court's preliminary ruling was made on January 26, the Zionist regime killed around 4,550 Palestinians and wounded more than 7,550, bringing the grim totals to 30,631 killed and 72,043 injured, South Africa states in its application. Israel has not changed its conduct materially or at all pursuant to the order. It has instead doubled down on its genocidal aims and acts and thus shown its contempt for the court. South Africa adds, noting that senior Israeli officials have poured scorn on the court and its order. South Africa requests in its application that the court order an immediate halt to all fighting and hostilities and demand that all hostages and detainees be released immediately. South Africa also calls for a provisional measure ordering parties to the Genocide Convention to comply with their obligations. It also asks the court to make more specific calls in regard to its earlier order on the Zionist regime to take immediate and effective measures to ensure the provision of basic services and humanitarian assistance to Palestinians in Gaza. In its application, South Africa identifies new facts and changes in the situation in Gaza, including the starvation death of children, predicting that they will increase exponentially and not linearly in the absence of a cessation of military activities and a lifting of the blockade. South Africa also notes that the Zionist regime's deliberate attempts to shut down the work of the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, on whom the vast majority of besieged, displaced, and starving Palestinian men, women, and children and babies depend for their survival. The Zionist regime has also seriously hindered the work of humanitarian agencies by blocking aid, targeting and killing humanitarian workers, destroying Palestinian food production and cutting off Gaza's north, reducing Palestinians there to eating animal feed, bird, seed and leaves unfit for human consumption. South Africa also observes that Israel has attacked crowds of desperate Palestinians attempting to access humanitarian aid, including the flour massacre of 118 people gathered for food assistance on February 29th. Palestinian civil society groups have meanwhile catalogued myriad Israeli violations since the International Court of Justice's January 26 interim ruling. This includes the Zionist regime's forces killing 14 journalists as of March 5th, four slain on the same day, as well as two lawyers working for the Palestinian Center for Human Rights who lost their lives in separate strikes on residential buildings, their families killed alongside them. In another of the deadliest attacks during the last 5 months, the Zionist regime warplanes and warships repeatedly struck Rafah in southern Gaza on February 17th, killing 83 Palestinians, including 27 children, amongst them displaced Palestinians who were sleeping in their tents, according to the Palestinian human rights and advocacy groups. Days earlier, Israeli regime troops ordered a Palestinian detainee, Jamal al-Din Mohammed Abu Ola, to enter Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis while handcuffed to tell those inside to evacuate. According to the Palestinian groups, as he was walking outside the hospital, still inside the gates, he was killed by an Israeli